This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2. Parenting with passion.
My guest today for Parenting with Passion is doctor and author and media personality, Dr. Cindy Pan. She has a new book out called Head Starts, 100 Tips for Raising Clever, Confident, Creative Kids. Welcome to the show today, Dr. Pan.
How are you, Katrina?
Good, thanks. Now, look, a lot of parenting books that I see are about following your instinct or just surviving the baby years and the toddler years with your sanity intact. But your book is really a little bit different. Just explain the concept behind it.
Look, a Head Starts is it's Head Starts, 100 Tips for Raising Clever, Confident, Creative Kids. And basically it's based on 100 different studies and papers, research papers, on different areas of child raising, everything from kind of antenatal to late adolescence, and covering different aspects of children's well-being, including sort of physical health, as well as mental health, emotional health, academic progress, but also things like social well-being and socialisation, all different aspects, and some things that are focused more on the parents' well-being as well.
Yeah, and the fact is that even with these studies, it's still not often black and white, but at least it is based on research and fact, isn't it?
Well, that's the whole point. Yeah. Nothing is black and white, and even though one lot of research might show this, of course, there's always other research that shows something different, sometimes just marginally different, but sometimes completely contradictory. So I guess that's the whole point of it, is we didn't want to present the truth as in this is the one truth and the only truth. What we would like to present is basically different views, and by citing the original research on which these views are based, we feel that we give the parent the opportunity to actually, you know, do a bit of reading themselves and see whether they agree with it or not. But the point of it is, it's not really a manual to tell you how to do it. It's really more information that's provided so that people have more information on which to formulate their own rationale for why they want to choose a particular approach to whatever aspect of parenting it is that they've got some quandary about. It's all very well that in some matters we do have strong instincts and we follow those instincts and it works, but I guess it's in those instances where we're not sure, or where there is conflicting information and we're not sure which lot of advice to listen to. That's when I think what's really important is, rather than just listening to a whole lot of advice, but to try and understand the rationale and the theory on which some of that advice might be based, and then to be able to tailor that advice to your individual situation, obviously your individual child, but often it's a question of tailoring it to the family and the whole dynamic.
Yeah, let's go through a few of the issues. I wanted to start with the issue of feeding babies and toddlers, because that is the first most consuming issue that new parents face.
Absolutely.
What does research show about how babies and toddlers should feed and be fed?
Okay, you've hit upon one of my favourite pet topics, in fact. As everyone knows, you know, breast is best from a nutritional point of view, and also from a point of view of, I guess, nurturing and attachment, which is not to say that if you can't breastfeed that, you know, you're doomed or anything.
No.
But, you know, obviously there are good things about breastfeeding, and it's not simply the chemical composition of the breast milk. A lot of it is, you know, the bonding and the nurturing, but it goes beyond that. What occurs when you breastfeed, particularly if you breastfeed on demand, is that the mother has to some extent, in fact to a great extent, relinquish control of feeding to the child, because it's up to the child to actually, you know, suckle and feed and stop when they want to stop. So they
fall off, you know, when they're finished, yeah.
That's right. They let you know when they want to eat, and they let you know when they want to stop. You can't force a baby to breastfeed more than what they're willing to suck, because they have to actively suck. And you're not inclined to try and make them finish the bottle, which is the baby equivalent of clearing your plate, you know, finishing what's on your plate.
Yeah.
I think that what it does is it not only gives the child some degree of autonomy and control over their feeding, which is a good thing, it also teaches the mother and the parents that children actually know when they're hungry and they know when to stop. And ideally, this is carried through to the toddler years and the childhood years, whereby parents try not to be overly intrusive and controlling in regards to feeding, that they recognise and respect that a child has their own, you know, very, very sensitive and very finely and well-tuned hunger and satiation centres in their brain, that they will seek out food when they're hungry, they will seek out fluids when they're thirsty, and they will stop when they want to stop. And telling them to clear their plate may be quite unhelpful, because what you're doing then is you're trying to force them to override their natural instincts.
Yeah.
And as adults, we know perfectly well what happens when people eat when they're not hungry and don't eat when they are hungry.
Ah.
We get all kinds of problems with obesity, eating disorders, and
yeah.
so on.
So it's healthier.
Preserve, maintain, respect, and actually nurture those natural instincts that children have. And I think the same goes to a great extent, not just for feeding, but for sleep and rest, play, work, all those sorts of things. I think, you know, we do actually have natural rhythms. And I think, if anything, we should try and support those rather than trying to quash them.
Mm.
I think, you know, within reason, try and just trust the child's instinct. Don't force them to eat when they're not hungry, and don't deprive them for overly long of food when they are hungry. Rather than having these kind of arbitrary timetables that you've set, maybe follow the child's feeding patterns just as you did when you were breastfeeding. I mean, when you're breastfeeding, you wouldn't have dreamed of going, look, time's up, that's it,
yeah,
because you know, they would cry. And you wouldn't dream of waking a baby up when they're fast asleep to shove a nipple in their mouth, would you? You'd never dream of it, would you? You would follow their cues. Well, what I'm trying to suggest is that to do that during toddlerhood, and even to some degree during childhood, is actually a really good idea.
Okay. Well, the other issue early on is actually bonding. And so how important is bonding in determining the future success of the relationship, that early bonding, I mean?
Okay, well, this is something that we cover in quite a lot of depth in the book. There are two aspects here. Like, obviously, early attachment is really important in terms of the child generally, as well as, of course, the mother-child relationship. And obviously, you know, we talk about, you know, a good attachment, and then there's obviously, you know, a sort of a more anxious attachment or avoidant attachment and things like that. But what we now know is that this issue of maternal sensitivity, it can often fluctuate. So it's not to say that, say, someone who was kind of had a strong and sort of stable attachment to start with, if the mother is exposed to or experiences a lot of stress, her maternal sensitivity can then be affected, so that the nature of her parenting might be sort of less sensitive. Mm-hmm. And what the studies show is that it's the more recent level of sensitivity that is actually more important. I mean, obviously, it's best if the mother can be sensitive all the way through, and obviously, you know, that securely attached babies continue to receive sensitive mothering. But in those situations where basically that there is one study which is covered in chapter 22, continuative care, where they looked at situations where, you know, there was good maternal sensitivity all the way through and relatively poor maternal sensitivity all the way through. But then they looked at both situations where the early attachment was secure and there was early sensitive mothering, followed by less sensitive mothering, and then the converse, that is, those who had a relatively less secure attachment as a result of less sensitive mothering early on, followed by a more sensitive more sensitive mothering subsequently. And they found that, well, obviously, as you could predict, those who experienced, you know, a secure attachment and had sensitive mothering all the way through, well, they did the best. And those who received relatively insensitive mothering all the way through, well, they obviously did the worst. But in those in which there was not the continuity, where they either received sensitive followed by insensitive mothering or insensitive followed by sensitive, those who had the insensitive mothering to start with, but then subsequently the mothering became more sensitive, they actually did better.
Mm.
So it was sort of the quality of mothering in the more recent period that was actually more significant.
So there's hope for us all then.
Well, I think what says is that it's what you're doing now and what you're going to do tomorrow that matters more.
Yeah.
So, you know, even if you feel that for whatever reason you were going through a divorce or your mother died or you had some terrible financial circumstances or whatever that interrupted your ability to perhaps mother as sensitively as you would have liked, and even if you feel that maybe there were some problems with infant attachment earlier on, it's what you do now and what you do ongoingly that, well, that, let's face it, that's the only thing you've got any real control of in some ways, until you invent a time machine that can take it right back. But yeah, but in fact, that, you know, what you do now actually does have more impact. And so,
well, it's good news if perhaps you were forced to go back to work earlier than you would have liked and you just weren't there or something, you know, that you can make up for lost time.
And the other thing that was interesting about that study is they found that, you know, this whole quality of the sensitivity of mothering, it was very, very closely related to, you know, the stresses in the mother's life. So in cases where the mother was dealing with much less stress than she'd experienced in the past, those kind of insecurely attached infants who later experienced the more sensitive mothering, that, you know, they did do a lot better. I think that once upon a time there was this idea that attachment was this kind of magical period that kind of somehow secure attachment would inoculate you forever against any kind of issues and problems.
Yeah.
I think that that's no longer accepted as being necessarily true, although obviously that is a crucial period. Mm. There's always time to make up for it. And the other issue is in regard to this secure attachment or insecure attachment is that they've done some really interesting studies looking at the quality of an individual's kind of infant maternal attachment and then their subsequent love life.
Yeah.
And this one I covered in one of the chapters, I think it's called First Love. And it basically, yeah, it looks at people's subsequent romantic history and, you know, how often, what their rate of, you know, divorce and this sort of thing is. Basically looking at the security of a person's infant attachment and looking at these two key factors that are thought to determine a person's expectations about having their needs met. And these expectations are thought to be laid down pretty much in our first few years of life, depending on the nature of our maternal attachment. And they are, first of all, whether we believe the person we're attached to will, in general, respond to our calls for support and protection. Two, which is also important, whether we believe that we ourselves are loving and lovable.
So that's laid down early.
That's laid down very, very early. And so as you can imagine, a person who, for whatever reason, due to the nature of their mother-infant attachment, is secure and they believe that they're lovable, they believe that they're loving, and they sort of trust that the person that they're with, that they're attached to and that claims to love them, will respond. Well, you can imagine the nature of that person's ongoing relationships are likely to be quite different to someone who's experienced a kind of anxious, ambivalent or avoidant maternal attachment as an infant, and who basically is not quite sure that the person they're attached to will respond to their calls for support and protection. So this person's going to be a lot more insecure. And this person is not completely sure that they themselves are able to be loving or lovable. Now, if you think about, like, which sort of person would you like to enter a relationship with,
yes.
Well, I think you can then predict, and in fact shows that there is some truth in the fact that, you know, those people who experience either an avoidant or an anxious, ambivalent kind of attachment as a result of having a mother who was either avoidant and constantly rebuffing them, or a mother who was anxious or ambivalent who was either slow or inconsistent in responding to their infant cries or needs for attention, or perhaps intruded on the child and forced attention on them when they actually didn't want to have that. The studies, and certainly the paper that that chapter is based on, did show that there was an immense correlation there. And certainly in terms of the proportion of adults who experienced secure versus anxious or avoidant relationships, it's very similar to the proportions of infants who experience secure versus anxious, ambivalent or avoidant.
It really correlates.
But obviously the nature of your early romantic relationships will then have an impact on the nature of your subsequent romantic relationships.
Yes.
So say you might have had, you know, an insecure attachment because your mother was problems with alcohol, or, you know, was constantly having relationship conflicts herself, or, you know, was bankrupt, or, you know, whatever was the problem, but, you know, you had like a less than ideal early run. You know, if you were to subsequently perhaps have a really positive experience with maybe a more secure individual, that might then change your expectations, and you might then start to actually realise that you are loving and that you are lovable, and that, you know, it is possible that somebody that you love and trust will reliably respond to your needs and be sensitive and responsive and all this sort of thing.
So again
it's
very interesting. It's very
interesting. You're up in an orphanage and got whipped every day.
It
doesn't mean, oh, you're doomed and you'll never find love.
No.
I think, you know, fortunately there are many inspiring stories of this nature. Children who have had, you know, even abusive histories, you know, and not necessarily even with therapy, but obviously often therapy may be helpful, but, you know, through subsequent positive, nurturing, truly loving relationships, and an experience of stable, responsive and sensitive loving, everyone is obviously capable of having secure and stable relationships. is. It might not happen overnight, but it will happen.
Yeah, sure. I'm speaking with Dr. Cindy Pan, and we've been talking about attachment and early bonding, and she's been drawing on some of the research in her new book, which is called Head Starts, 100 Tips for Raising Clever, Confident, Creative Kids.
This has been a Hope 103.2 podcast. For helpful articles, station news, videos, devotional emails, and more podcasts, visit hope1032.com.au.